Matthew goes on from where we were in chapter 13. Now, chapter 14 is the story of the loaves and fish, which is identical with Mark, just copied really into Matthew's text. And then comes the scene which is also in Mark, but it's a beautiful example of how the gospel is written. After the loaves and fish exodus story, Jesus, as you know, comes to them across the water. Well, I'll read you what Matthew says. Immediately, Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side, while he dismissed the crowds. After he had dismissed the crowds, he went up the mountain by himself to pray. That's straight from Mark. When evening came, he was there alone. But by this time, the boat, battered by the waves, was far from the land, for the wind was against them. Early in the morning, he came walking towards them on the sea. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified, saying, "It's a ghost." And they cried out in fear, but immediately Jesus spoke to them and said, "Take heart, I am, it is I, ego, eimi, do not be afraid." Word for word from Mark's gospel. But look what Matthew does. Peter said, "Lord, if it's you, command me to come to you on the water." Jesus said, "Come." So Peter got out of the boat, started walking on the water, and came towards Jesus. But when he noticed the strong wind, he became frightened, began to sink, and he cried out, "Lord, save me." Jesus immediately reached out his hand and caught him, saying to him, "You of little faith, why did you doubt?" Then he rejoins Mark. When they got into the boat, the wind ceased. Those in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you're the Son of God." And when they'd crossed over, they came to land at Gennesaret. I'm sure you can see what's happening as we learn to read the gospel properly. Some people initially think Jesus walked on the water because he was God. Well, God can do anything except walk, but anyhow, that's another matter. God can walk. So, and then you say to them, "Well, okay, well, what about Peter? Is he God too? He walked on the water too." And then they look puzzled and don't know what to say. It can't be about that. It's chaos, and Jesus is rising above the chaos, but he's saying, "You can do it too. Peter is us. Come on, you can do it. You can do it in your marriage, if you're married. You can do it with your kids, if you're a kid. You can do it as a priest or a religious sister or a bishop or pope. As long as, this is the key, isn't it? As long as he keeps his eye on Jesus. But as soon as he takes his eyes off Jesus and says, "Oh God, what am I doing?" he starts to sink. And Jesus won't let you sink, so he grabs you and says, "Oh God, how often?" So next time they went, probably Peter tried it again and gradually learnt to walk on water. Meaning, because Peter walked on water in Rome when they... Paul walked on water every time he went to Jerusalem. Not literally, but really. Walking on water means being out of our depth, not able on our own to cope, and having to cry out to Jesus, and he just says, "Come." If he doesn't say, "Come, stay in the boat," of course, it's the best place to be. It's a sensible place to be. And when Peter leaves the boat, he's not actually thinking, "All right, I'll leave the boat." He just can't. He wants to go to Jesus, so he goes. And if you go to Jesus, you happen to step out of the boat, you don't even notice till you take your eyes off him. I'm sure you get the message. But it's right, it's a beautiful example of how you should read the gospel stories. They're actually about you and me. They're about everybody. They've chosen scenes that are typical of Jesus' life. Jesus walked on water every day of his life, and he taught his disciples to do it too. And I don't mean foot on top of wet water. But Mark doesn't mean that either, neither does Matthew. And Matthew clearly is inviting, Jesus is inviting us to do what he's doing. Cross, like the redemption, cross over the Red Sea, dry shod, and the water stood up to the left and the right. You know, again, a marvellous story, not a factual account. Caesarea Philippi, we've already heard that from Mark, but again, Matthew takes it somewhere. Jesus said to his disciples, "Who do you say I am?" And Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." That's in Mark's gospel. Matthew adds, "the Son of the living God," which is the Messiah was the Son of the living God, so that's not a big addition, but this is. Jesus answered, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. Flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. And I tell you, you are," and I'll give you the Greek, because the New Testament is written in Greek, "you are Petros. And on this Petra," it's a play on words, the word for rock is Petra. Petros is a male name. "So you are Peter, and on this Peter, this rock, I will build my church. And the gates of Hades will not prevail against it." The gates of hell can be translated, as in the Apostles' Creed, as long as you know that there are two words in the English that hell translates to Greek words. One is Gehenna, that's the fire of hell, you know, lost, separated from God forever. Well, Jesus didn't descend into Gehenna. He descended into Hades, or Sheol in the Hebrew, the underworld where the dead are. So that's the gates of Hades will not prevail, the gates of death, you could say, will not prevail against the church. The church isn't defending itself against some enemy. The church is actually attacking, and the enemy is death. Paul says the last enemy to be destroyed is death. And it's not an enemy either. If you're with Jesus, you'll never die. But that image is put there for us. And he says, "I'll give you, Peter, the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. And whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." At some stage, I don't know when, no one knows when, the timing is not, because the Gospels don't often answer that question. At some stage, Peter emerged as the leader of the group. We all know that. In John's Gospel, it happens after the resurrection, as we'll see. "Peter, do you love me? Feed my lambs, feed my sheep." You know, that's the post-resurrection. Mark doesn't have it anywhere, but Matthew does, and he has it at Caesarea Philippi. Does he mean to tell us that at Caesarea Philippi that's when Jesus appointed Peter to succeed him? It doesn't mean that. It means that Peter has chosen this powerful scene where for the first time a disciple says, "You are the Christ. You, the one we've got to know and love." Not this vague image we've got and learnt about and could be a priest, could be a prophet, could be a king. No, you. You're the Messiah. You're the one we're looking forward to, the one we're dreaming of. Well, on that beautiful occasion, here the word church is used for the first time in Matthew. It's only used once other time, and it's not used at all in the other Gospels. The church, the community, those called out, that Peter becomes the leader, and our church, the Catholic Church, Roman Catholic Church, believes that what happened to Peter was handed on. In other words, the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, succeeds in this role. And it's a lovely idea, and it's been around for 2,000 years, so it's not a modern idea, But there are other Christian groups who, while no one doesn't recognize Peter, other Christian groups think that, no, that wasn't handed on, like some of the other apostolic things weren't handed on. So that's where the disagreement is, and sadly, among the Christian churches. And some of the other Christian churches are very close to us and would be very happy to see the Pope as the first among equals, you know, that they look to for symbolic, but they can't, they don't like the way the Pope exercises his power. So please, God will get a Pope one day who doesn't exercise it in a way that they don't like, and maybe we've got one. But in any case, the power is the power of love. So no one's going to object to a Bishop of Rome who loves, but they will object to a Bishop of Rome who organises who's going to be a bishop and who's not going to be a bishop and controls the system. And maybe they're right, and maybe we're a bit too obedient. Anyhow, that's enough said on that. But you get the picture of this. So we're in a complex human, but the church is of course based on Jesus, and here Peter emerges as the one that Jesus entrusts leadership to in Matthew. And there's this beautiful scene of the Transfiguration. There's a painting of it, but I haven't got it here. It's by I know it, but the name won't come. A beautiful painting. It's called The Transfiguration sometimes. If you know the name, shout it out, because I know it, and I'll bet you probably do, but I can't get it at the minute. And then down below, you've got the scene when Jesus is up on the mountain. You've got down below, you've got a man there with his boy who's kind of mad, and you've got the nine apostles, three of them up with Jesus, and you've got all this going on. And up there, Jesus is in prayer, transfigured. I'm sure you know those scenes, and it's an absolutely stunning. And now I've remembered through all that talk, Raphael is the one who painted it. If ever you go to Rome, please go to the... Don't go to St. Peter's. St. Peter's has a copy of it in stone, in like these mosaics you've got around here, and it's beautiful. But the painting is in the Pinacoteca, I think it's called, the art gallery of the Roman, and it's stunning, just wonderful. Oh, and by the way, this is not unrelated to you, in the painting by Raphael, you've got, as I described it to you, it's hard to describe it, it's got, up the top you've got Jesus and Moses and Elijah, you know, and the three apostles. And then down below, you've got this scene I described, and the only one connecting with Jesus up top is the boy. He's clearly not all there, but he's pointing up and looking up to Jesus, and no one else is. The apostles are all looking at the book and discussing things and writing rules and selling what all blah, 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 blah. And the dad is intent, saying, "Can't you help my boy?" It's really quite beautiful. And in the middle of the painting, she's not in the gospel story, but she's in Raphael, is a woman. My God, she's strong. I wouldn't like to bump into her. And if you took her to the bishop's conference, they'd all be a little bit tentative. And she's looking at them and saying, there are no words, but you can see she's saying to them, "What's up with you blokes? What are you waiting for Jesus to come down from the mountain from? Why don't you do something about this boy, you know?" And she's called Faith by Raphael. In fact, I think he called the painting Faith. She's Faith, and the rest are all church politics going on. So don't underestimate your power, girls. All right. Matthew 18. If a shepherd has 100 sheep and one of them has gone astray, doesn't he leave the 99 on the mountain and go in search of the one that went astray? No, he doesn't mean abandon the 99 there. He's got kids that'll help and look after them because they're okay. But his keen interest is, where's this one? So if he finds it, he may not, but if he does, very truly I tell you, he rejoices over it more than over 99 that never went astray. He's just so overwhelmed with joy, the way the prodigal father was about this boy coming home and so on. So it will be, if the will of your Father in heaven, it's not the will that one of these should be lost. So for Jesus, God is so sensitive to everybody, and his first movements are of longing and compassion and reaching out to you and me or the outsider or the leper and so on. It's a beautiful, simple story. Matthew has a fourth lot of sayings, and they're about the church and how we relate to each other in the church. It's fairly primitive, and we've come a long way since it, I think, but every now and then you get some little gem like this. Where two or three are gathered in my name, I am there among them, says Jesus. Peter came and said to him, Lord, if another member of the church sins against me, how often should I forgive? Seven times? And dear Peter, and he's looking over his shoulder trying to impress the others, I think. You know, I'm willing to do it seven times. What about you, John? Are you willing to do it six or five? But I'll do it seven, like a fool. And Jesus says, no, 77 times or 70 times seven. So Peter goes, what? In other words, you've got to keep forgiving. Now, reconciliation is only possible if two agree, as you well know. But if I was to hurt you, you can't really forgive me till I accept the forgiveness. I mean, there's always something happening. But you can be ready to forgive me. You can not be bound by what I've done. And you're not the problem. I might be. I might refuse till something, whatever. But if it's such good psychology for a start, not to hold grudges. But because when I forgive you or you forgive me, we're creating the environment in which the person can change. Without that, they probably can't. So we're meant to do what Jesus did. Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. That's how he put it. And most people are doing their best. Then comes the thing about marriage, which I won't go into now, but I will read this because this is only in Matthew. So he's talked about marriage, they've asked him about divorce and all that, and I think you know that, and he quotes with interesting differences, but it's much the same as Mark, and Jesus' disciples said to him, well, if that's the case, if you've got to stay with the woman for the rest of your life, God help us, it's better not to marry. Very nice male chauvinists, weren't they? Oh, and Jesus says, this is quite lovely. It's about our lives. Not everyone can accept this teaching, but only those to whom it's given. He's going to talk about quite a special grace of not marrying. There are eunuchs who've been made so from birth. And even the church used to make them members of the Sistine Choir in the early days. So that the grown men still had a boy's voice because they did something to make sure they didn't mature. And they were lovely singers. Anyhow, we do odd things. So there are eunuchs made so from birth. There are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by others. So that's what I'm talking about, the second group, the first group, whatever. Now, there are eunuchs, they can't have children, who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. They've chosen not to have a sexual partner, marriage, family, grandchildren, life. You know, they've chosen not to do that. Should they have chosen, it'll depend now. If a man or a woman is going to remain a boy or girl by not involving themselves in this complex thing of intermarriage, then maybe they shouldn't do it because they're not going to mature. Most people need that in order to mature. Most people do. But Jesus wants us to grow and mature and become self-givers, generative, lovers. Without that, well, that's actually quite difficult, as you all know. In fact, Jesus says, and it's really beautiful, see, this is a special grace has to be given to do this. And then he says, I've translated it this way, if you have space in your heart for this, do it. That's my translation, because it often just says, I don't know how they do it otherwise, but the verb used is that. Now, I don't expect you to know Greek, you may. Chorein. It's the same word in choreography. Choreography. It's about dance. It's organizing a dance. It's space. It's a space word. And so Jesus is saying, look, if your heart's big enough to be able to mature and grow and love and become a beautiful disciple of Jesus without the normal processes of family, then do it. Because it's a, well, none of us would be celibate if Jesus wasn't, and he was. So the best love of the world's ever known was celibate, so it gives us hope that we can be celibate. We cannot have the responsibilities and the involvement and the correction and the care and all those things that come. So when I leave here and go home to Canberra, I'll walk into a thing and I'll walk into my room and I'll put my... Women have been much nicer than this, and I'm not saying anything against anybody, and I'll put my bag in the corner and I'll go to bed. Like, there's not going to be a kid running up and jumping into my arms, and there's not going to be a wife happy to see me. but I have to walk past the chapel to get to my room, so maybe there is someone waiting for me there. Okay, you right? So, but it's a lovely image of Jesus. You need a big... Think of someone you know who has a big heart. Might be your grandmother. Might have been your own mother. Might be a sister of yours. Might be one of you. Someone who's got a big, big heart. St. Francis. St. Clair. You need a big heart to be a religious. While Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside and said to them on the way, this is in Mark, but I didn't do it in Mark, see, we're going up to Jerusalem and the Son of Man will be handed over to the chief priests and scribes, and they'll condemn him to death. Then they'll hand him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. Some people read that and think, which is understandable if you haven't learnt how to read the gospel, that Jesus knew everything before it happened, you see. He's just letting little bits of information out gradually, but he knows exactly what's going to happen. He can see the future. Well, human beings can't see the future because the future depends on millions of free decisions that anybody could make. So you can't. You can get an idea of how things are going, as you know. We can often tell. It's highly likely, but then we get surprises. So we've got this intuitive feel, and Jesus had that too. So no doubt he was aware that they were trying to kill him. That was pretty obvious, and there were a lot of resentment and there was a lot of plotting going on. So none of that is surprising. And then after the event, when the gospel is written by, in this case, Matthew, they're not reading it back into it, but they're seeing that Jesus actually foresaw that he was going to get into trouble. Of course he did. And they put their words on it. Mocked, flogged, crucified. Well, did Jesus actually say that? I don't know whether he actually used those words. He may not have. But he could tell he was heading for trouble. And he's warning them, look, if you follow me, it's not going to be a bed of roses. It's not going to be just, no, be careful. There's going to be suffering involved. Because see the way they're rejecting me? Well, they'll reject you too. So you have to be strong and in love to do it. Then he says, and on the third day he will be raised. And it's very difficult for us not to read Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Crucifixion, resurrection, third day. You got it? Well, that's kind of what you think without thinking. So that looks like it's all summed up. In other words, Jesus knew he was going to die, and he knew that on the third day, 2 days later, he would rise. Well, who says he rose on the Sunday? No one was there on the Saturday. You know, what are we actually talking about? It was discovered on the third day that he wasn't there. The tomb was empty. We'll come to that. The problem is that on the third day is a biblical term that has not an obscure meaning. On the third day. If you were to read Exodus chapter 19, it's about Moses going up the mountain, and five times, I think it is, in about six verses, God says to Moses, he says, tell the people to prepare for the third day, because on the third day I will come down from the mountain, etc. And then on the third day, on the third day. On the third day means the day when God shows who God is. We do all our mucking around and human thing, but on the third day, and it doesn't mean the day after the second, but on the third day means on that day when God reveals God's love and desire and will. That's the third day. We're going to meet it on the Cana story again, which happens on the third day. So we've got to have a good look at that scene again when we do John. So Jesus is saying, in effect, life's tough. We're going to have a lot of problems around the corner. We get to Jerusalem. But I put my total trust in my Father, and I know in whom I believe, and he will take me into his embrace. And so it's an act of profound, it's not a foreseeing of Friday, Saturday, Sunday, it's a profound act of trust in God. There's another phrase in chapter 20 that I've got you there. There's a very important one. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life. It doesn't say die. It says give his life. Well, that's what love is. To give yourself, give your life. So we're asked to give our life. That's it. And that's what being a Christian means. One who gives his or her life for others and to others, because that's what love is. Well, he's giving his life to liberate many. We did that on the Last Supper with Mark. To liberate the multitude, not a little group, but not this little group of apostles and not their hangers-on, but in fact the whole world. He wants to ransom, the word used for coming out of Egypt, take us out of Egypt to the promised land. That's his one desire. Then there's all these confrontations in Jerusalem, which Mark talks about, and so does Matthew, and I don't intend doing them. Just a few little things here from chapter 23 of Matthew. A saying of Jesus, if you exalt yourself, you'll be humbled. If you humble yourself, you'll be exalted. And then this very tragic thing when Jesus weeps over the city. Jerusalem, Jerusalem. So he's been coming to Jerusalem, now he's arrived. The city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. How often have I desired to gather your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings. Lovely female image of God, which you don't have enough of, but there's one beautiful one there. The mother hen drawing the little ones. I've often desired to do that, but you weren't willing. You wouldn't come. He wouldn't let me. And so he says, your house, your temple, is left to you desolate. Jesus can see, he wasn't the only one, but he could see that the way things were going in Jerusalem, it would soon be destroyed, because the Romans, the anti-Romans, the whole situation was clearly, there was going to be a catastrophe, and he could foresee it, and he was trying to get everyone to change, but he failed in doing that. So the city, some years after his death, was destroyed by the Roman armies. Chapter 24 and 25 are about what is the ultimate judgment? What matters in life? What really, really matters? And you know this so well, but this was Jesus' image of judgment, meaning what ultimately matters in your life, how our lives are judged. Successful, unsuccessful, this is the thing. Come, he says, you who are blessed by my Father. Inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. And why? Why are you going to inherit the kingdom? Because I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and it was you who gave me clothing. I was sick and you took care of me. I was in prison and you visited me. We all know that so well and we're familiar with it, but it's so simple and absolute and clear. And keep remembering that they say, well, when did we ever... So Jesus' love reaches out to everybody. It's beautiful that we know him and we want everyone else to know him. And we want everyone to belong to the community that knows him, which is the church, of course. The mission is still there for us and we want it. But people who've never known Jesus, or people who've rejected Jesus, but not really rejected him, but just rejected Jesus that their dad taught them about, which was narrow and bigoted and whatever else comes into life. In other words, people who do this, people who live like that, are listening to Jesus and he's drawing them to himself. And they'll get a surprise. We'll get a surprise too, but not quite the same, because we know about him. We're kind of expecting it, hoping for it. They're not. But when they come and he'll say, g'day. And they'll say, oh, don't remember seeing you. And he'll say, oh yeah, remember that time you... Well, that was me. Because he identifies with all the poor and the broken. I was hungry and you gave me food. The Last Supper is... the same as Mark, but there's a nice addition here that's very important. I'll read you the text. While they were eating, Jesus took a loaf of bread, and after blessing it, he broke it, gave it to his disciples, and said, take, eat, this is my body. Straight out of Mark. Then he took a cup, and after giving thanks, he gave it to them, saying, drink from it, all of you. This is the blood of the covenant, poured out for many, straight out of Mark, but he adds, for the forgiveness of sins. That's not in Mark. And sometimes we can forget that too. Maybe you don't, but we can. When we think of forgiveness of sins, we think of the sacrament of reconciliation, which is beautiful, important, and has its own special mood about it. It's primarily for people who've left the church and want to be welcomed back. That's why the priest does it. People who've been excommunicated in the early church and so on. So it's a public way of drawing people back into the community. That's its primary purpose. But we've, over the years, and nicely, used it for other mortal sins that don't separate us from the church. And we've also used it for venial sins and spiritual direction and, you know, all that. And that depends on what your relationship is with the priest and how wise he is and all that. But we mustn't forget that the main sacrament for most of us, all the time, or most of the time, for forgiveness, is not the sacrament of reconciliation, it's the Eucharist. We say, Lord, have mercy and forgive your sins, when this is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world, all the way through the Mass, as you well know. But here it is, right in the heart of the consecration. This blood of Jesus is being poured out for the forgiveness of sins. The ordinary sins of daily life are forgiven by love. Jesus' communion of love with us, because where there's love, sin can't stay, heals, sheds light on, burns up sin. And in these days, when in an ordinary parish, fewer people come to reconciliation than used to. And when I was a boy, we went every week. Maybe you did too. Maybe you still do. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's a beautiful thing. It's got a special grace about the sacrament. But most people don't. You know that probably. And maybe you don't go nearly as often as you used to when you were a novice. I don't know. Well, I don't anyhow. I try and go once a month. But it's amazingly how often the month takes 2 months to get round. Only because you kind of, life's busy and you'll forget. But anyhow, and it keeps us tuned. It's a good sacrament, a beautiful sacrament. But isn't it lovely to think that the main sacrament is the one of communion with Jesus? And he embraces us, and we get tuned by that love that we encounter at the Eucharist. But he goes on and says something. I tell you, I will never again drink of the fruit of this vine. It's his last supper with them. It appears that way anyhow, and it is. Until the day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. That Matthew has it again, and we're going to see it in a few moments. He's going to drink it with you, so it's a communion. And he'll say it again at the end of the gospel, I am with you. So Matthew's very aware of this communion with Jesus. So are the others, but Matthew states it a couple of times where they don't. I'm with you to the end of the age. The agony in the garden is the same, basically, in Matthew. He copies Mark. The arrest and trial are the same. The crucifixion and death and burial are basically the same as Mark. He just copies it because it's beautifully said already, and you can't do better than Peter. So he's got it, and he's got no extra words to put in. Then comes the empty tomb and the resurrection of Jesus. And Matthew has only one scene after the empty tomb. Mark has none, we saw that this morning. The women didn't tell anybody, they were afraid, just like the community in Rome. Here we are, in Antioch probably, and Matthew has this wonderful scene that completes his gospel. The 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them. The Last Supper, he said, I will go ahead of you into Galilee. After you've run away, you could see they weren't ready, but don't worry, I'll be there for you. I'll be at Bethlehem. Is this the name of this convent, isn't it? I'll be there at Bethlehem for you when you come back from your hospital or holiday or whatever it is, or you're visiting your sister. I'll be there waiting for you. Well, he said, I'll be with you at Galilee, and here it happens. The 11 disciples went to Galilee, of course, to get away from Jerusalem and all the mess and the Romans, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them. When they saw him, they worshipped him. But some doubted. We're going to see a lot of that in Luke and in John. Seeing the risen Christ is not something you do with your eyes. So if you're a blind disciple would have seen as much as one with eyes. That's obvious, but worth saying. It's an encounter. It's an awareness. It's a faith experience, just as it is for us. The difference between their experience and mine and yours is they could recognize Jesus, whereas we believe, but we can't recognize him because we never knew him in Galilee. So we know who it is we're encountering, who is encountering us, but we know in faith, and the faith goes right back. 2,000 years of saints have convinced us that that's what it is. But for them, they saw him, but the text always does, and it will also in Luke tomorrow, in John, there's an element of doubt in it. So it's not real clear. It's kind of this, it requires faith. Jesus came and said to them, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me." This is the risen Christ, who's, "Go therefore, make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father," that's the one that Jesus called Abba, God, the Creator, the Father, "in the name of the Son," that's Jesus, "and of the Holy Spirit," which is the love. That's Jesus' heart, Jesus' spirit, the love he has for the Father, the prayer of Jesus. So it's the communion of love that this beautiful Jesus has with the one he called Abba. So that's, I mean, you can look at the Trinity more abstractly if you want to, but I'm not going to do that with you now, because that's a later theological thing and quite wise and beautiful and profound, but I'm staying with the gospel. The Son is Jesus and the Holy Spirit. So baptize them in this whole revelation that Jesus has made, and teach them to obey everything I've commanded you. And John will make it clear what that command is. Love one another as I have loved you. That's the command. And look at the end, the final ending of the gospel. Remember, I am with you always to the end of the age. And that's what I have to remember and you have to remember. And with that, we conclude our meditations on the glimpses of Jesus that Matthew might enrich our lives with.